That, and I mean, I just don't know enough about the inner workings of the research that they were doing. Nevertheless, they had a competitive catalyst, platinum rhenium, which had some features like platinum iridium and some different features, but definitely had advantages over platinum catalysts. The platinum rhenium catalyst, its virtue wasn't so much higher activity than platinum, but it showed higher activity maintenance than a platinum catalyst. So both platinum rhenium and platinum iridium showed better activity maintenance than the platinum catalyst. So they could run for longer periods, or you could run them at more severe conditions for the same length of time. But the platinum iridium catalyst also had the advantage of a higher activity. So we went ahead and commercialized the platinum iridium catalyst. Chevron commercialized the platinum rhenium catalyst. They actually had their first commercial unit in 2 years before we had ours. They had a platinum rhenium catalyst in one of their plants in 1969, as reported in, I guess, the Oil and Gas Journal. We first applied the platinum iridium commercially in the fall of 1971. Now, turns out that we use both platinum iridium and platinum rhenium catalysts in Exxon. And in some units, we use both catalysts in the same unit because they have different features. Platinum rhenium has advantages for certain types of reactions. A catalytic reformer tends to be, it's a multi-reactor system. You usually have several reactors in series, possibly three or four reactors in series. And as I mentioned, you have many different reactions going on in catalytic reforming. And the way it turns out is you can almost isolate certain reactions with regard to the reactor. The cyclohexanes, for example, go to aromatics very much faster than anything else that happens in the system. So the first reactor will largely be conversion of naphthenes or cycloalkanes to aromatics. It turns out that the platinum rhenium has advantages relative to that reaction from the standpoint of the selectivity of conversion. Platinum iridium tends to have some advantages for reactions near the tail end of the system where you're talking about the conversion of, say, an open chain alkane like normal heptane to toluene. This is a much tougher reaction than the conversion of cyclohexane to benzene. In other words, it occurs at a much slower rate and is one of the limiting reactions in reforming. So we have units where we actually have platinum rhenium in the front end of the system and platinum iridium in the tail end of the system. So the point I'm trying to make here is you've got these two catalysts came out there at about the same time. They both have advantages over platinum. In some respects, they're alike. In some respects, they're different. Certain types of application, one catalyst will have an advantage, and other types of application, the other one will have. And so it's not an either, I mean, it's not an all or in one direction. Well, now to complete this picture, I might point out that later on, after these two catalysts had been introduced commercially, Universal Oil Products came up with a different type of process for reforming. They developed a process called continuous catalytic reforming, which basically is a system whereby it's sort of reminiscent of fluid hydroforming, whereby they withdraw catalyst on a continuing basis from the reactor and burn the coke off and then add that catalyst back to the system. They're doing this continuously. Although it's not a fluidized bed, they call it continuous catalytic reforming, and they developed a platinum tin catalyst for this, which is operated at very low pressures compared to these processes. Now, there's advantages to operating at low pressures because low pressures, low hydrogen pressures, favor the formation of aromatics. But they also favor huge deactivation rates of the catalyst because the lower in hydrogen pressure you go in a reformer, the more you're susceptible to coke formation. Well, that's why they had to have the continuous process, because they're having enormously high rates of coke formation. But now that process is being used. It tends to have much higher investments in the hardware of the unit, but by being able to operate at very low pressures with this feature of the continuous withdrawal and regeneration of catalyst, they can get higher gasoline yields. And so that's being used quite widely now. Point I'm making is that you have a changing situation and you have different catalyst and process features, and that the optimum for one application might be quite different from another. Now there's, while we're on the subject of, do you want to pursue this more? Tends to show the changing nature of things in the industry and what can happen to the researcher as the result of this. I mentioned earlier that when the bimetallic catalysts were first introduced around, let's say, about 1970, which is very close to both Chevron and the Exxon introduction of the bimetallic catalyst, there was this interest in lead-free and low-lead gasoline. Well, and you needed something to replace the lead in gasoline, and that's going to be more aromatic hydrocarbons. So that bimetallic catalyst then played a very important role in influencing the economic feasibility of lead-free gasoline. In effect, you could say it was very important, almost crucial, to be able to go ahead with that development. Okay, so that, in that sense, it had a very important environmental impact. It allowed you to take lead out of gasoline and get rid of this the lead, which can have harmful consequences of its own as a pollutant. But in addition to that, removal of lead from gasoline had the additional impact that it permitted automobile exhaust catalysts to be applied. Because when you put catalysts in the exhaust system of an automobile to remove the carbon monoxide, the unburned hydrocarbons, if you have lead in the gasoline, the lead going through the exhaust system will deposit on the catalyst and poison it. And so you can't use a catalyst then. So by the development of bimetallic catalysts, by making it feasible, or improving the economic feasibility, let's put it that way, of removing lead from gasoline, you made it possible to use catalysts in automobile exhaust systems. So it was very important from an environmental feature. Okay, so that's true for a period of about a couple of decades. But now in the last few years, we have a situation where people are now becoming concerned about the possible environmental effects of aromatic hydrocarbons themselves. Could they be bad actors? And as you've known for some time, benzene has been a concern. And so for some times there's been restrictions on the amount of benzene that you can put in gasoline. Well, now they're becoming more and more concerned as we become more and more, as we dig deeper into environmental questions, people wonder, well, could aromatics in general be a problem? So there's been a tendency now in recent years for, even though reforming played a huge environmental role in the positive sense 20 years ago, people are now wondering about whether reforming is going to become an environmental problem itself because of aromatic hydrocarbons. And so there's, you know about the pressures in the last couple of years to try to cut back further on aromatics content in gasoline and putting things like ethers and so on into gasoline to replace them for their anti-knock and properties, and also to give you they claim that with ether in the gasoline, that tends to help to decrease the emissions from the automobile exhaust system and so on. So now we're in a situation where reforming had grown over a period of about 40 years from the days of Val Hensel's first commercial unit to a point, let's say, by about 1990, where it's replaced all the platinum catalysts in the world. The process is almost on the scale of catalytic cracking, not quite. Catalytic cracking is still the largest, but it's right up there, enormously important. And now we're probably peaked. It's probably going to be a situation where we're not going to see very much expansion in reforming for the near future because of the pressures to limit more and more the amount of aromatics you put in gasoline. So the question that you have now is what is this scenario going to be? I don't think for the foreseeable future we're going to have to abandon reforming altogether. I think it's just so important in fuels that for a long time it will still be an important contributor to the gasoline pool. But the reason I go into all this is to show that how the landscape looks over a period of time, and for the industrial researcher, how it changes. I mean, you can say you're an environmental hero 20 years ago, and then today they're giving you a hard time. I don't mean to, maybe I was being a little dramatic about talking about being an environmental hero. There were lots of people important in the evolution of lead-free gasoline and so on. But you can see the changing nature of things over a period of time and how you have to adapt.
You really spent the rest of your career, a good part of your career, continuing to detail these bimetallic chemicals.
Yeah, well, that maybe I ought to say a few minutes, talk a few minutes about that. After I had worked in the bimetallic catalyst with chemical probes and had developed a commercial catalyst, that you go back to a point like 1971. What do I do now after you've done this? You say, what do you do now? And one thing I could have done would have been to explore bimetallic catalysts for all kinds of different applications. In other words, that would have been a perfectly valid thing to do. And maybe some people think that was the only thing you should have done. But I did look at some other kinds of applications. But I was interested in another thing, and I think that gets into the fact that I'm primarily science-oriented. I wanted to dig deeper into the bimetallic catalyst with some other types of studies. And it was becoming possible to do this in the early 1970s, where it hadn't been, say, a decade earlier, and I had to depend solely on those chemical probes. One of the things that made it possible was the development was going on out in the Boeing laboratories in Washington, in Seattle, Washington. There's a fellow named Farrell Lytle out there, L-Y-T-L-E, and he had been playing around with a X-ray absorption spectroscopy for about a decade before I ever met him. He was playing around with that in the 60s when I was playing around with bimetallic catalysts. And Lytle made some very important contributions in that subject. He was particularly interested in the fine structure, which you see in an X-ray absorption spectrum right after an absorption edge. What you see after an absorption edge is you see some oscillations in the absorption coefficient. It's a periodic type of a behavior, which extends maybe 1,000 electron volts beyond the edge. Like if you were, say, at the copper X-ray absorption edge, which would be the edge itself comes in about 9 keV, 9,000 electron volts. That's for the K edge of copper. That's the amount of energy required to eject a K shell electron from a copper atom. Then for about 1,000 volts beyond that edge, you'll see these fluctuations in the absorption coefficient. Well, this phenomenon is very old. It goes back to the 20s. But nobody ever did anything with it much. People wondered about it, what caused it, and there were some theories that were advanced, I guess mainly by physicists in the early 30s. There was always the question, are the fluctuations due to some sort of ordering in the material? Like if I were looking at a platinum, do these fluctuations have something to do Is it a long-range order kind of thing, or is it a short-range order kind of thing that are responsible? It felt that these fluctuations had to be tied into structure somehow like that. But people develop long and short-range order theories. In other words, as to put whether you got long-range order, or the kind of thing that you would want if you were looking at X-ray diffraction, as opposed to some kind of a short-range order that might be characteristic of an amorphous material, a non-crystalline material. Well, Lytle casts some very nice light on this. He started working with this phenomenon in the early 1960s, and he started doing experiments at very low temperature. A lot of the work which had appeared many years ago had been done around room temperature, so Lytle started doing experiments down around liquid nitrogen temperature, and he found that these fluctuations got bigger as you went to lower temperature. First thing that meant was it made the experimental determination of these easier, because the fluctuations were small, and if you got low temperature experiments, you greatly magnified the effect. Okay, that's because there was several reasons for this, but Lytle noticed that first of all. The second thing he noticed was that he could observe these excess fluctuations for amorphous materials as well as crystalline materials. So he had good experimental evidence that this was a short-range order kind of thing. You didn't need long-range order to observe excess fluctuations. So those are very important things. And then Lytle himself came up with sort of a zero-order theory to explain some of this and to make a rough attempt to derive information like interatomic distances, coordination numbers, and so on, out of analysis of these fluctuations, which we don't have time to go into. Well, Lytle took, and these were enormous contributions in my mind, and Lytle appreciated that he had here something that might be important for determining the structure of materials. And he got together with a physicist from the University of Washington by the name of Stern, and he had a graduate student by the name of Sayers. And the three of them more or less collaborated and developed a theory of X-ray scattering to account for these excess fluctuations, and developed some improved techniques for getting structural information on them. Well, it wasn't long after that they published a paper in Physical Review Letters, which I was not aware of at the time. That was published in 71, the same year Platinum Iridium came out. And I met Lytle shortly after, simply by chance. And he started talking to me about this phenomenon of X-ray absorption, and he calls this extended fine structure. They called it extended X-ray absorption fine structure, and gave it an acronym, EXAFS, E-X-A-F-S. And he started talking to me about it, and he got me very excited, because you see, I was ripe for it. I was trying to decide, what do I want to do now? And one thing that appealed to me was doing something to try to dig deeper into the science of these things. He started telling me that he could get this stuff and get this information about amorphous materials. He didn't need long-range ordering in a material. And I thought, well, gee whiz, I'm interested in buying. And he said, he got to me because since I knew nothing about X-ray absorption spectroscopy, he had to appeal to me in the most elementary way. He explained that what the crucial thing he could do was to learn something about the local environment about an atom. In other words, he said, if I have an atom A and I got neighbors around it, of A and B, I can tell you how many A's I got and how many B's I got, coordinated to it. I said, that's what I need, because I got a bimetallic cluster, I got nickel and copper in that. I'd like to know how many copper atoms are coordinated to nickel and how many nickel atoms are coordinated to nickel. I'd like to know their interatomic distances and this stuff. And he said, I can also tell you something about the disorder in there. You know, in a crystal, metals or atoms are vibrating back and forth, and that's dependent on temperature, and that's the way, that's why these excess fluctuations depend on temperature. And he says, we can learn something about that. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is a veritable, huge amount of information that we can get out of this. And I said, well, I've got to learn something about X-ray absorption spectroscopy. So how do I go about this? I don't know anything about it. And so I figured the only sensible thing to do is try to somehow get a collaboration going with Lytle, because he knows what he's doing. And maybe I can learn from him, and we can develop techniques that can tackle catalyst problems. So I talked to Lytle about that, and he was very much interested in it because he had a technique, and he would like to see some kind of a problem that we could really move with this technique. And I had a problem, and so we were natural collaborators. And then there was a guy in the company here by the name of Grayson Via, that's V-I-A, who I had worked with with X-ray diffraction on lots of problems, and I thought it would be good to get him involved in it. Then I had to sell the people in the company about allowing me to collaborate with a guy out in Boeing, because there wasn't much of this kind of stuff done. I mean, people tended to keep things to themselves and so on. And I convinced him, well, let's get Lytle in here on some kind of a consulting basis. It will allow us to have a collaboration. And I said, Boeing's not interested in catalysts. We don't have to worry about that. So I had that sales job to do with the lawyers and the managers and so on. Finally, they let me go ahead. And so we got this collaboration going, and Lytle came in here, and he showed Grayson and me how to set up some equipment of the type that he had used back at Boeing to do this, and we modeled an apparatus after his apparatus, and we started doing some experiments on these things. Well, it turns out that we were using these ordinary X-ray tubes, and the flux of the X-rays you get out of them is not great enough to do the experiment in an ideal way. By that I mean is that with the fluxes we could get, it would take us 3 or 4 weeks to do an experiment on a single sample. Because, you see, you had these small fluctuations, and you have statistical noise and so on, and you've got to get the data to be statistically significant, so you had to count for a long period of time. So we were doing some of these experiments, and we took the ruthenium copper system. It took us about a year, and we still weren't completely done with the system and everything we wanted to learn. But we got some convincing data that showed we were on the right track. We could definitely show that we could get information on the structure of these clusters. And so that was an important development, because it said that you could take these dispersed catalysts now from a scientific point of view, and you could learn something about their structure with a physical probe like this. In other words, you're no longer limited by the amount of gas they would absorb or by just finding out what kind of reactions they'll catalyze. We could now get something independent and see how well how consistent it was with what we learned from chemical probe. So I was very excited about it, but it was very slow going, and we figured, okay, we'll look at a couple systems, but we're never going to be able to look at all the stuff that we got involved in. Then we were lucky again, because in 1975, you know, they have this high-energy physics facility at Stanford, the synchrotron, and it turned out that they have a byproduct in the operation of that unit which puts out X-rays of all kinds of energies. So you have a whole spectrum of X-ray energies, and the flux is about a million times greater than it is out of an X-ray tube. So what's that mean? If you have access to that Stanford facility some way, you could do your experiments in a few minutes that we're taking 3 or 4 weeks to do here to get the same statistical significance and so on. So it turned out that at Stanford, they were interested in making this byproduct. This was as far as a pain in the neck, I guess, to some of the physicists, this byproduct radiation was coming out. But to us, it was great. And they made it possible to go out there and do experiments using this synchrotron radiation. So we actually developed a proposal here in 1975. I remember it was about Christmas of that year, and went out there and did our first experiments with the Stanford synchrotron source. And indeed, you could get these experiments done in a few minutes that took you the weeks and so on. So then, after that happened, over the next 10, 15 years, we did a lot of work out there. And later at Brookhaven, out on Long Island, they developed a similar facility later on. And we would go out there for maybe a week at a clip with a bunch of samples and so on, and do a lot of X-ray absorption experiments. And we had a setup out there so you could treat your samples in situ in an environment similar to what you would actually run in a catalytic reaction. You could have gas in the cell and so on. And so over a period of time, we looked at lots of these systems. We got information on coordination numbers and interatomic distances. We could determine, we could see from the XAFS data when one of the components was tending to segregate at the surface of the other one. We could get that out of the data. So we spent a good long period of time on that phase. As I said, I could have probably taken the other approach and just explored other kinds of chemistry over these, but I preferred to do this. And I'm not sorry for it. Somebody else might have taken a different course, and he might have had an equally or maybe more productive experience. Who can say? But I'm still interested in X-ray absorption. Because it turns out, in addition to the information you get from this fine structure beyond the edge, which tells you about crystal structure, cluster structure, by looking at the edge itself, there are structural features in the absorption edge, which tell you something about the electronic properties of your material. And we get back to this so-called electronic factor. I better check to see if somebody's trying to get it. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine.
But since it was a short question, and the reason I thought maybe somebody might have been coming to get it. Now, where were we? I was talking about the X-ray absorption and the fact, in addition to structural information from the fine structure, we could look at the structure of the edge itself. That's where you get your discontinuity in the absorption coefficient. In other words, when the energy, the X-rays, becomes high enough to eject a particular electron from the atom, like in the case of copper, it takes 9 keV to eject a copper atom. There you get an abrupt increase in the absorption. That's the absorption edge. And the edge will have structural features itself which relate to electronic properties of the system. You can learn about things like oxidation states in a system. You can learn something about this D-band filling that I was talking to you about. As a matter of fact, you can correlate structural features in the edge with the degree of filling of the D-band in the pure metals. And I've gotten involved in a lot of that, which has been quite interesting. But that's been one of the development. Another thing, that interesting thing, if we can pursue this just for a little bit, in the course of the last 20 years, I got involved in another area that was new for me, too. I got involved through a collaboration with a physicist in a university. I got involved in nuclear magnetic resonance studies of catalysts. This was an area that in the late 70s or about 1980, let's say about that time, I had been giving a lecture at the University of Illinois, which was a joint seminar where there were chemists, physicists, and material science people in the same audience. And Professor Charlie Slichter, who does a lot of work with nuclear magnetic resonance, has been for his whole career, was in the audience, and I was talking about dispersed catalysts. And he came up to the after the talk, and he said, he's in physics at Illinois, and that's where I went to school, although I didn't know him at the time as a student. And he said that he's always wanted to study the nuclear magnetic resonance of small metallic particles, but he didn't know how to make the particles.